Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On October 3rd, 2018, Senate Judiciary Chair Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, discussed the possibility of a Supreme Court opening in the last year of Donald Trump's term. Here is that clip.
This may make you feel better, but I really don't care. If an opening comes in the last year of President Trump's term, and the primary process has started, we'll wait to the next election. And I've got a pretty good chance of being the judiciary.
You're on the record.
Yeah.
All right.
Hold the tape.
That was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham speaking at an event for The Atlantic magazine on October 3rd, 2018. Well, this morning, just 11 days before the presidential election, Lindsey Graham moved forward with a vote to advance the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. The vote was 12-0. The 10 Democratic senators on the panel boycotted the vote and filled their seats with photos of people who rely on the Affordable Care Act for health care. If the ACA is repealed, between 20 and 30 million people would lose their health insurance. We did a show about this last Friday. Yesterday, we spoke with Adam Cohen, author of Supreme Inequality, about what a 6-3 conservative majority would mean for voting rights, LGBTQ rights, widening inequality, Social Security, Medicare, and more. And you can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. On today's show, we are talking about what it might mean for the future of reproductive rights, and we'll also talk about birth control. In a piece for NBC, today's guest, Mary Ziegler, writes, "With Barrett on the court, there is almost no doubt that the justices will gut Roe, if not reverse it outright. Anyone concerned about abortion will have to pay close attention." Mary Ziegler is professor at Florida State University College of Law. She specializes in the legal history of reproduction, sexuality, and the Constitution. She's the author of several books, including her latest, Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
And in her latest piece for Mother Jones, today's other guest, Becca Andrews, writes, "There's something darkly poetic about putting forth a mother of seven as the justice who could deliver the end of the constitutional right to an abortion." Becca Andrews is a reporter with Mother Jones. Her forthcoming book is called No Choice, which is based off of her 2019 cover story for Mother Jones about the obstacles for getting an abortion. And I hope you can take time to read her piece about it today. It's called When Choice is 221 Miles Away, The Nightmare of Getting an Abortion in the South. Hi, Becca. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, before we start the show, I just want to mention that polls continue to show that the majority of Americans support keeping abortion legal. And Mary, I just have to be honest here. I am just kind of shocked that we're having this conversation in 2020. I always knew that it was possible, but I guess I just kind of felt like, you know, in the year 2020, there's no way that they're going to further gut Roe. I mean, we're going to talk about how hard it is in many states to get an abortion, but we're talking about possibly getting rid of it in many, many states. I'm just curious, as someone who follows this so closely, writes books about it, what are your thoughts this morning?
Well, I think if you follow the history of the abortion debate, this is very much a fulfillment of something that started before Roe v. Wade, which was the idea that Roe would be reversed. And of course, that would not be the end of the story. There would be a fight for a right to life in the states and potentially nationally, too, which would mean an abortion ban everywhere. So this is a long time coming, right? This is decades in the making in terms of social movement struggle. And so it sooner or later was a matter of time, if the GOP continued winning elections, that we would have a Supreme Court willing, it seems, to overturn Roe. So as much as it seems surprising given polling on Roe, which has really not changed much since the 1970s, it's not surprising because we have a pretty savvy single issue social movement that's organized around the idea of getting rid of Roe and then securing a right to life. And that movement has been really aligned with the GOP with that sole aim in mind. So in that way, it isn't surprising, even if it's a policy that would be enacted without a lot of public support.
Becca, what would you add? I mean, you've interviewed women who have to travel across two states in some cases to have this procedure. So what are you thinking about this morning?
Yeah, I think I would just highlight that the right to an abortion is not, you know, it is federally protected, but it's not a reality in every state in the United States. This has been a gap that's been going on for a long time. As Mary said, the attack on abortion rights has been amping up. Particularly in Republican state legislatures for many years now. So I think it's important to recognize the inequalities that already exist and that will be exacerbated should Roe fall.
Mary, based on the writing that you've done, how far do they want to go? Are we talking about abortion being illegal in all states? What about rape and incest?
We're talking about abortion being illegal in all states. That's the aim. I mean, it's worth remembering, right, that if you're opposed to abortion, if you're pro-life or anti-abortion, you believe that abortion is murder and you believe that life begins at fertilization. And so it would be incongruous if that's your belief to say it's okay to commit murder in California, but not in Texas. That makes no sense. So the goal is some kind of national solution that outlaws abortion everywhere in blue states as well as red states, and obviously states in every shade in between. How, you know, that happens is unclear, obviously. And then so in the short term, you would expect to see, according to the Guttmacher Institute, there are 21 states that would ban all or most abortions should Roe be overturned. Most of those policies don't make exceptions for rape and incest. And I think that's probably just the beginning. Obviously, other states could choose to ban abortion going forward. They just don't already have this kind of trigger that's ready anytime Roe is overturned. But I think it's probably worth saying that unless or until there's a sort of national abortion ban, people who are opposed to abortion won't really be that satisfied, because the movement is organized around not getting rid of Roe v. Wade, but recognizing a right to life. And a right to life means no abortion anywhere. It doesn't mean just no abortion in the South, to Becca's point, or the Midwest, or places that might actually vote that way.
What are they saying about penalties?
There's some really interesting questions about this. So I know there's some reporting that's actually coming out of NPR this week on this question about who should be punished, right? I mean, the punishments we've seen authorized in laws that exist are pretty harsh, but they tend to focus on physicians. So there'll be a question going forward about whether that should include women too. So it's a complicated question, right? So historically, women were not punished directly. They tended to be punished more from a standpoint of stigma, right? So they would be forced to testify, they would be publicly humiliated, but they wouldn't actually go to jail. Of course, we live in a different world now, because people can order medication for abortion on the internet. They can travel much more easily out of state. And it's going to be hard in states that want to ban abortion to do anything other than punish women or pregnant people, unless they just want the laws to be symbolic. And I think that there's some awareness of that among abortion opponents. And there's a divide, I think, even though the official movement line is pretty clearly no punishing women. I think in the kind of grassroots rank and file, there's much more division about this. And I think that those divisions will grow if it becomes clear that you can't enforce an abortion ban without punishing patients, which I think is just an inevitability given the logistics.
Well, Becca, what would you add?
Yeah, I would also point out that the criminalization is something that is very much already happening in some places. Particularly, criminalization of abortion is geared toward low-income women and women of color who face charges for taking medication or for taking drugs that complicate the pregnancy or terminate the pregnancy, whether it's intended or not. Particularly in the South, this is more of a thing. So, you know, what Mary says is absolutely correct. You know, the anti-abortion movement is very reluctant to punish women outright for abortion. And I think that's a big part of their sort of the veneer of feminism that they kind of like to put over their movement, particularly in the past decade or so. But yeah, criminalization is something that will not, I don't see criminalization affecting middle-class white women going forward. I see it probably affecting low-income women of color.
In the piece that you wrote for Mother Jones, you write that while Mississippi does not have a law that criminalizes drug use while pregnant, prosecutors in at least one county, Jones County, have fashioned a loophole through which approximately 20 women have been charged under a, quote, felonious child abuse statute, reasoning that if a woman uses drugs, she is poisoning the fetus and therefore is criminally liable. And we will talk about Lori Bertram Roberts, who heads the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund, later in the show. But she told you that she actually put up bail for one woman who was jailed under that statute.
Yeah, absolutely. She did. And Jones County is a really interesting example of this. And it goes into these broader, they're known as chemical endangerment laws. Basically these laws allege that women are chemically endangering their fetus if they take a certain kind of drug, anything that's under this law. And this is very much a thing in Alabama. Nina Martin at ProPublica has written really well about chemical endangerment laws. But I would expect to see an escalation of that.
It's so interesting, Mary, that we're talking about this today as we're getting news out of Poland, where their abortion laws were already among the strictest in Europe. And I'm reading right now from the BBC. Once their new decision comes into effect, terminations will only be allowed in cases of rape or incest or if the mother's health is at risk. This is just happening right now in Poland.
Right. I mean, I think one of the things that often is true historically is that once you start outlining specific reasons, essentially saying abortion is illegal, but for these reasons, it tends to lead to a kind of downward spiral where no abortions are legal. Because then, of course, what happens is abortion opponents will say, well, you know, women are lying, basically, right? They know they can get abortions for health reasons or rape or incest. So how can we really tell if they're victims of sexual assault, or how can we really tell if their health is being threatened? So the analog in the United States when it comes to low-income women was the federal Hyde Amendment, which some listeners may know bans Medicaid reimbursement for low-income women who are having abortions. And the Hyde Amendment always has had, and at the beginning had, exceptions, right? So you could get a Medicaid-funded abortion, and for example, in cases of rape and incest or health threats. And what happened was that the number of Medicaid abortions went almost to zero because it was very hard for patients to prove that they actually qualified for those exemptions. There was immediately an argument that women were lying, and that argument became a justification for eliminating exceptions, right, and criminalizing all abortions. So often once you start down that road, that's not where you stop.
Joe Biden said in June that he opposes the Hyde Amendment. This isn't getting much attention, but this is very important, Mary.
It is, and it's very, from a historical standpoint, it's a pretty big deal because the Hyde Amendment was the source of a kind of bipartisan consensus for really decades, right? And I think it's fair to say that the pro-choice movement never really made the fight against the Hyde Amendment a priority, which has been one of the reasons why historically the pro-choice movement was a predominantly white movement, right? The movement was not prioritizing what happened to low-income women or women of color. And I think women of color understood that. And it was pretty much a given that both Democrats and Republicans would support the Hyde Amendment. There was a brief period when Bill Clinton tried to get rid of the Hyde Amendment, but really no one has given it that much effort or thought. And Joe Biden himself, of course, has been around for a while, once was in favor of the Hyde Amendment too, as most Democrats were. So Democrats breaking ranks on that and now opposing the Hyde Amendment, I think, shows you how much the party has changed and also how much what it means to be pro-choice has changed.
Mary Zeigler is professor at Florida State University College of Law. She's the author of many books, including her latest, Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. We're also joined today by Becca Andrews, a reporter with Mother Jones. Her forthcoming book is called No Choice, which is based off of her 2009 cover story for Mother Jones called When Choice is 221 Miles Away, The Nightmare of Getting an Abortion in the South. And today we are talking about the future of abortion rights. We'll also talk about birth control later in the show with a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court. What are your thoughts as Amy Coney Barrett is almost 100% set to be confirmed next week? What are your thoughts about that, the future of Roe? And if you remember what life was like before abortion was legal, if you have been working on these issues, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about the restrictions that are already on the books. I mean, we've done so many shows about this over the years. According to the Guttmacher Institute, nearly half of the 58 new abortion restrictions enacted in 2019 would ban all, most, or some abortions. They say the surge in abortion bans is a departure from the strategy deployed by opponents for decades, which was to adopt less sweeping restrictions with a cumulative impact on denying care to patients. This approach has led to the passage of laws that were less likely to be challenged in court than outright bans. Becca, before we dive in and talk about your piece specifically, can you just talk about how so many of these laws have really affected women and girls?
Well, I think what's interesting about the onslaught of anti-abortion legislation is that, you know, we're seeing sort of a race among conservative legislatures to put forth the law that, you know, takes down the right to an abortion in this country, right? That makes it all the way up through the federal courts to the Supreme Court, and gives the conservative justices the reason to finally start chipping away at the right to an abortion in this country. And in the meantime, certainly women and girls, particularly in these states, are the ones who are suffering the consequences, right? I mean, for the most part, so many of these laws get really caught up in the courts and get paused. And that's thanks to litigation helmed by Center for Reproductive Rights and ACLU and Planned Parenthood. But still, I think it does, there's a cultural cost that people don't think too much about. I think that these are places where abortion is very much taboo and not something that you talk about. And there's a clear sort of immorality that comes with getting abortion care. And I think that really takes a toll on people, especially if they're faced with the decision that they didn't ever see themselves making in the first place. You know, I think we've also seen this play out even in the very beginnings of education, right? Like we see it in sex education, particularly in conservative states, where young women, young girls are not being taught about their own bodies. Like they don't know how their bodies work. They don't know the functions of them. So of course it creates this sort of mysterious nature to their own bodies. And then that you see that sort of trickle down like throughout the rest of their lives. And it really takes a toll on women seeking healthcare broadly too.
Mary, what would you add about the restrictions that are already in place?
Well, I think the other thing to note about the restrictions is that they are intended actually to be challenged in court, and they're intended to eventually lead to the overturning of Roe. So the kind of savvier lawyers in the anti-abortion movement understand that even a conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court will probably want to keep up appearances up to a point and show some serious consideration for precedent, even as they undo it. So the idea, I think, is to kind of deal Roe v. Wade a death of a thousand cuts, which would mean both limiting access to abortion in a cumulative way, but also making the idea that there actually is an abortion right anymore kind of incoherent and farcical, right? So if you technically have a right to abortion, but this government can decide the reasons you can have the abortion, the techniques that have to be used to perform the abortion, the timing of the abortion. The idea would be that sooner or later, the Supreme Court would look at that and say, well, what is really left here? There's no right here anyway, so it's not much of a big deal for us to overturn Roe. So that strategy has always been predicated on the idea that that would actually lead more effectively to the overturning of Roe than some of the more sweeping things you've seen in recent years, like heartbeat bills or absolute bans. And it's worth noting that if the Supreme Court takes an abortion case, they could overturn Roe in any abortion case. It doesn't have to be an absolute ban or a heartbeat law. As long as abortion is before the court, they can make decisions about whether to undo Roe or achieve something similar.
Is there going to be a case in the near future?
There quite possibly could be. I mean, as you can imagine from Becca's reporting, there's no shortage of options. There's one case that the court will not make a decision about whether to hear until after the election and after Amy Coney Barrett presumably joins the Supreme Court. That is a case out of Mississippi that where, among other things, Mississippi has lots of abortion restrictions. This one is about banning abortion at 15 weeks. So the Supreme Court already has that petition and could choose to act on it any time, really, after the election. There's no shortage of other options. There's a couple of laws banning dilation and evacuation, which is the most common and safe second trimester procedure that the court could choose to take up. And that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg. There's lots of cases making their way through the pipeline, and there's one that the justices already have before them. So it's just a matter of time, I think, until they decide to hear one of those cases.
Let's talk about how these laws are actually affecting women on the ground. Becca, in your piece, you write that Mississippi, for example, has the second highest poverty rate in the country. In 2014, a study found an estimated 47% of all pregnancies were unintended. In 2017, Mississippi's birth rate among 15 to 19-year-olds was 65% higher than the national average. And in your story, you write about Kate, who has been trying to get an abortion for months, and she had to travel hundreds of miles from Mississippi to Arkansas to get the procedure because it is banned after 16 weeks in Mississippi. Can you tell us a little bit more about Kate and her story?
Yeah, absolutely. Kate had a really rough go of it. She, as I said in the piece, she's a college student. She didn't have a lot of money. When she found herself pregnant, I think it was very emotional for her, and it took her some time, as it does with a lot of women who unintentionally become pregnant. It took her some time to sort of deal with that and to really recognize what was happening to her and what was happening to her body and realize what she needed to do. So she found Lori Bertram Roberts, who helms the Reproductive Freedom Fund in Mississippi. And Lori talked to her for several hours, just trying to get a sense for who she was and what she needed. Kate didn't want to go to the clinic in Jackson, Mississippi, which is the only remaining clinic in Mississippi, partly for fear of being recognized. She was just nervous that someone would see her. Jackson's clinic also has a pretty aggressive protester base, and so she was worried about being identified or all of these things that would understandably stress someone out who's trying to just get basic health care. So it was decided that they would take her to the clinic in Little Rock. So this means, because it's such a far distance, right? It means getting up really early in the morning before dawn. It means hoping to God that traffic doesn't mess up the scheduling. She's in this massive van and she's going to Little Rock with people that she barely knows because she can't afford to get basic abortion care in her own state. She has to leave. And for Kate, she had to go several times, partly because of onerous abortion restrictions, and partly just because there were, again, like a lot of emotional things that, she was dealing with too. So it was very arduous for her, you know, to be completely frank. I was a little surprised when she ended up getting her abortion. I wasn't sure it was going to work out.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll continue the story about Kate. Lori Bertram Roberts and her family actually drove Kate to Arkansas. They left at around 7:45 and they had an appointment at 10:45, but they got there at nearly noon. And so this is what, you know, people like Kate are dealing with. And Lori Bertram Roberts is doing work in Mississippi with the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund. And we'll find out more about her work after a break. You can find that story at yourcallradio.org. Becca Andrews wrote that piece. She's a reporter with Mother Jones. We're also joined by Mary Zeigler, professor at Florida State University College of Law and author of Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about what a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court would mean for the future of reproductive rights. According to Refinery 29, 5 states have just one clinic that provides abortions: North Dakota, South Dakota, Missouri, West Virginia, and we're talking about Mississippi. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Becca Jones is a reporter with Mother Jones, and we are talking about the piece she wrote, "When Choice is 221 Miles Away, The Nightmare of Getting an Abortion in the South." She is writing a book based on that piece called No Choice. Mary Zeigler is professor at Florida State University College of Law. Mary is the author of many books, including Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, it's obviously no one's... The stories of these women, there are so many stories. It's no one's business about why women need these procedures and want these procedures. But I think it's when you think about someone like Kate, Rebecca wrote that at first her boyfriend said he would pay for the procedure, and then she found out he didn't. And then he said that he didn't want her to have an abortion. I mean, there are just so many, everyone has a story. And that's the thing that rarely comes out. It's like there are no faces to overturning Roe. I mean, what are your thoughts about that, about humanizing this?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think there have been efforts to do that, but I think that the anti-abortion movement has been pretty successful in stigmatizing abortion, right? And to some degree, the way we provide abortion care feeds into that. Abortions are almost always performed in freestanding clinics. Those clinics may also provide other services, as Planned Parenthood often does, but they tend to be family planning services that are somewhat aligned, or services that touch on sexuality. It's easy to isolate those clinics for protesters. And there's been a sense in which even Americans who support legal abortion don't view abortion as a good thing. And so I think that makes it hard for people to talk openly about their abortion experiences. And that's even more true in places in the South and the Midwest that have strong pro-life or anti-abortion majorities, because there, of course, the personal cost of talking about the fact that you had an abortion would run much higher, because you'd be risking alienation from your family, from your community. Who knows about what that would do to your job prospects or your other relationships. So there's a sort of, and the people, of course, who are more comfortable talking about having had abortions are often in states where there's no real threat to abortion access to begin with. And I think there's a kind of self-reinforcing logic to that that makes it hard from a political standpoint for people really to understand what it would mean in concrete terms. And I think that extends to what it would mean potentially for things like birth control, too.
And then also just what women have to deal with in just walking into a clinic. Becca, you were talking about all of the protesters. You wrote that Kate kept her head down as a man bellowed that God would not judge her. And then when she was in Alabama, She had to leave her cell phone in the van. This is a security measure meant to protect patients and stymie anti-abortion activists who pose as patients and then film people inside the clinic. So even just walking from your car to the clinic could be a traumatic experience.
Absolutely. And it was very much for Kate. And even, you know, I'm interviewing a lot of people about their abortion stories for the book. And I hear a lot about the trauma of going through these hordes of protesters. You know, they're very aggressive. They're very vocal. It's frightening.
Mary, once Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, how do you think the protests and the violence outside of the clinics will change?
It's hard to predict, right? Because usually, historically, there's actually an uptick in violence when things are going badly for abortion opponents in the Supreme Court and in national politics, right? Often people resort to violence because they feel that they can't get the job done any other way. So there may not be an uptick in violence, but I think there's sometimes the more abortion opponents win, the more impatient they become, right? And I think that you'd likely see probably a big surge in abortion restrictions not long after Amy Coney Barrett joins the court, akin to what we saw in 2019 after Brett Kavanaugh joined the court. But there may still be some who are not satisfied with the pace of change, because even a very, very conservative Supreme Court is a slow Supreme Court, right? I mean, if you start to realize the laws that were passed in 2019, the heartbeat laws, are not even done making their way through the circuit courts of appeal, right? None of them are even ready to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. So these things take a long time. And of course, for people who are extremists, that's not okay, right? Even if they ultimately would get what they want from the Supreme Court anyway. But generally, it's the highest risk of violence from an abortion standpoint tends to be when abortion rights are more secure, not less. So it wouldn't be a particularly high risk time, although there's always risk when it comes to this subject.
Right. And Becca, you report that Lori Bertram Roberts wishes that her fund, which helps women get abortions in Mississippi, but it does so much more than that. They also work with families and moms. She says, you know, she wishes the fund could overcome these obstacles by helping women like Kate manage their own abortions at home, largely with medication abortions. But in Mississippi and 33 other states, it is now a crime to use medication to induce an abortion if that medication is not administered by a licensed clinician. Mississippi also bans the use of telemedicine, in which doctors see a patient remotely. So 34 states now make it a crime to use medication to induce an abortion?
Yeah, and I should specify that during the pandemic, a lot of the telemedicine restrictions have been waived, just in the interest of being able to get people care without risking infection of the coronavirus. But yes, that's a major barrier. A lot of the organizing that we see around increasing medication abortion access and increasing telemedicine access is really for the benefit of rural women in particular. You know, if you think about where clinics are, right, they're often in larger cities and metropolitans. They're, you know, some women have to travel, you know, 100 miles, 200 miles to get access to abortion care. And with something as simple as taking medicine, you know, you should be able to do that in the privacy of your own home, particularly considering how safe medication abortion has been proven to be. I don't have the numbers right at my fingertips, but, you know, it's about the same as taking an ibuprofen. Like, there's not a ton of risk with it. So it's frustrating that we have this solution and, you know, this potential solution to access, but it's, you know, overregulated.
How is this enforced, though? How are these pills banned?
That's a good question. So it's not enforced well because, you know, as you're sort of getting at, I think it's difficult to enforce, right? We have seen some crackdown on people who distribute medication abortion. So, the woman whose name I'm blanking on now, I apologize, but who heads up Women on Waves has been prosecuted for distributing medication abortion. Women on Waves helps women get access to medication abortion. So, you know, I don't think we're seeing a ton of crackdown on women who are taking medication abortion. I think more of the focus is going to be on figuring out where it's coming from and cracking down on sort of the, like, quote unquote, black market. But yeah, you know, it's not very well regulated at this point.
Mary, what are your thoughts about this? Because I've been thinking a lot lately about Women on Waves. We did a show about them years ago. They provide contraceptives, workshops, safe and legal abortion services outside territorial waters in countries where abortion is legal. And they have a whole section on their website that says, if you live in a country where there's no access to safe abortion and you'd like to obtain pills, please go to womenonweb.org and learn more. So how do you see this playing out? Because if it's not available, people will, you know, try to get order these pills.
Absolutely. I mean, we already know this is happening. And I think it'll probably have two effects. I think it'll make abortion bans if we do have them, right? So, I mean, this is already happening in the sense that states don't allow, as Becca was saying, don't allow people to take abortion pills without physician supervision. But of course, it will also happen if states actually ban abortion and can enforce those bans. So it'll make the laws much harder to enforce because, of course, there won't be any kind of public act, right? Like leaving your house and going to a clinic. But the tricky thing, of course, is that will also increase the odds that women will be punished for having abortions. So at the moment, as we were saying, the anti-abortion movement has been very adamant that women are not going to be punished. Of course, if it's going to be hard for states to punish the people who are sending the pills, many of them are not living in the United States. They could be sending the pills from abroad, or they might be sending the pills from states where abortion is legal. And in any of those cases, you're not going to have states or countries extraditing doctors for doing something that's legal where they were doing it. So that's going to leave states with the option of either punishing no one or punishing the women in the state who are ordering the illegal abortions. And I think it's, again, more likely to be low-income women who face those kinds of consequences because people with more money will probably be likely to get better maternal care, be less likely to suffer complications, because that's really how people wind up getting caught. They take medication abortion, and although complications are rare, they either have complications or think they're having complications and then seek medical care. And then it's discovered that they were using abortion medication, which can then subject them to legal consequences.
Can we talk more about how this will affect low-income women the most? According to the Guttmacher Institute, nearly half of abortion recipients live below the federal poverty line. And Becca, in your piece, you cited 2017 data from the Kaiser Family Foundation that found more than 1 in 10 women in Mississippi receive health coverage through Medicaid and likely can't afford to pay for an abortion or non-emergency contraception on their own.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about people who are living below the poverty line, likely they're concerned with things like feeding their families or keeping up basic health care for them. You know, contraception in some ways may feel like an extra luxury. Women's health care broadly may feel like an extra luxury. It may actually be an extra luxury, I should say. But, you know, that constant judgment of, you know, what money goes where when there's such limited resources. I mean, of course, you can imagine that takes a toll and that, you know, leads to disparities in abortion access.
Becca Andrews is a reporter for Mother Jones, and you can read her pieces at yourcallradio.org. Mary Zeigler is professor at Florida State University College of Law and author of several books. Her latest is Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. You can join us at 866-798-8255. We're talking about what's in store for the future of reproductive rights with a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Janet in Marin County. Hi, Janet. Thank you for holding.
Morning. Thank you for taking my call. This is really an important issue, just this whole Roe versus Wade. I understand it. It's an extremely difficult decision for a woman to make. But one thing that I don't hear anyone talking about is the already 400,000 children in foster care in the United States. Their families can't take care of them for one reason or another. Where is this, you know, being talked about or discussed?
Well, thank you. Mary, what are your thoughts?
Well, one of the sort of odd things about our contemporary political alignment is that you would expect to see people who are opposed to abortion also being in favor, for example, of contraception or in favor of a kind of broader social safety net to make abortions less common, right? And to help foster children, among other things. But I think because the anti-abortion movement is a single issue movement and it's aligned with the only party that seems to vow to give it a Supreme Court that will overturn Roe, all of those options don't get a lot of political play, even from people you would expect them to. And I mean, one would hope that that will not be a permanent feature of our politics, but it certainly seems that way today because there's a kind of interdependence when you're thinking about abortion opponents and the Republican Party. And the Republican Party, of course, is not interested in a broader social safety net for anyone, really including children.
Becca, anything to add?
Yeah, I would also add that this is a criticism that the so-called pro-life movement faces often. You know, it's all about regulating women's bodies and it's all about regulating reproductive care up till the point that a baby is born, and then it's like, figure it out. You know, like there, like Mary was saying, there's not a lot of investment in social safety programs. Although I will say I have seen some, you know, pro-life feminists, as they call themselves, coming forward in more support of that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely true that people who are opposed to abortion don't all agree on this, right? It's more just that, and I think many people who, there's many sort of Catholic social justice types who are progressive on some other issues. But I think people who are single issue voters, of whom there are quite a few on the anti-abortion side, will sideline those concerns in return for a promise that Roe v. Wade will be gone and a right to life might be recognized, which means that from the standpoint of kind of national political conversations, solutions on things like the needs of foster children are harder really than they should be because abortion is such a major issue for so many voters.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for calling in, Janet. We've been wanting to do a show about foster care, but with the election, we're just so slammed. But we'll definitely do this after the election. There's also a piece in Talk Poverty called Amy Coney Barrett Could Determine LGBTQ People's Access to Adoption. And in this piece says, this November, the Supreme Court will hear arguments on Fulton versus the City of Philadelphia, which will decide whether foster and adoption placement agencies have the right to use their religious beliefs as an excuse not to comply with non-discrimination protections. So this is another very important case that we will be watching. Thank you for calling in. Mark writes in, the evangelicals call birth control an abortifacient and eventually will make it almost impossible. There are cases working their way to the Supreme Court. The left can't imagine, however, the far right won't give up. The left has to rise up because once it happens, a liberal president can't make it happen if the Supreme Court declares it unconstitutional. Mary, what can you tell us about birth control? There was a piece in Slate, and according to this piece, it says Amy Coney Barrett must know that several state legislatures, in their zeal to ban abortions, already have introduced legislation that could ban birth control and the IUD.
Yeah, I think that's a real possibility. So some states, just to take one example, Missouri has a law that says when we say abortion, we don't mean anything the FDA has licensed as contraception. But many states don't have that kind of rule, which of course invites questions about what abortion means in the first place. And many people who are pro-life or anti-abortion believe that life begins at fertilization. And they also independently believe that a lot of common forms of contraceptive actually act as abortifacients. So IUDs, certainly emergency contraception like the morning after pill, like Plan B or Ella. There are some abortion opponents who believe that the regular vanilla birth control pill is an abortifacient because it can block implantation. So it's fair to say that in any state that bans abortion, there'll have to be a conversation about what does it mean to ban abortion, and does that in fact include contraceptives too? I think that's almost inevitable if abortion bans fall into place.
Becca, what are your thoughts?
You know, actually, I feel like Mary really covered it.
Yeah, Mary, do you really think that in some states they would try to ban birth control?
I mean, it would be a stupid idea for them to try to ban birth control, right? So Henry Hyde, we were talking about the Hyde Amendment earlier, whenever he proposed an abortion ban, he would be very careful to say, I don't mean birth control, whatever, you know, I'm not going after IUDs, I'm not touching the birth control pill, that's not my intention. But I think that there are many people who, for religious reasons, see some forms of birth control as abortion, right? And they wouldn't see it as going after birth control, they would see it as going after abortion. So when there are fundamental disagreements about what we even mean by abortion in the first place, then I think it certainly is on the table, especially like I was saying for emergency contraception and IUDs. I think those are probably the two things that would be the most up in the air. There aren't that many leading anti-abortion groups that are worried or talking much about the pill. And one of the ways you can get guidance on this is, of course, during the fights about the contraceptive mandate of the Affordable Care Act, a lot of leading anti-abortion groups described IUDs and emergency contraception as abortifacients. So we already have a sense of what they think on those subjects. So I think those things absolutely would be on the line.
How are reproductive advocates planning for this? Becca, in your piece, you write about, we've been talking about Lori Bertram Roberts. And I mean, she does what she can with a limited budget to help women, to help them in all aspects of their lives, pay for healthcare, diapers, food, contraception, wherever there's a need, the fund tries to fill it. What are you hearing from reproductive rights advocates and how they're planning for what's to come?
I should also clarify really quickly that Lori recently took a job as executive director of the Yellowhammer Fund in Alabama. So now she helms the Alabama Fund and also the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund. So she's very busy. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of concern about this. There's been, you know, a lot of people are going around saying, like, you should stockpile Plan B. Reproductive rights organizers say, please don't do that. That will drive up the prices and make it harder for low-income women to access to begin with. I think right now there's just a lot of fear and a lot of sort of scrambling to make sure people can get access to whatever they need. But I should also say that this is a clear failure on a systemic level, right? You know, that people even find themselves in these situations in the first place, and that Lori, who has, you know, kids, who is a low-income woman herself, who has her own life and is navigating the challenges of being low-income, that she is the one who's having to like rise up and meet these needs is just a clear failure of our country, I think.
Right. She leads the only abortion fund in the entire state of Mississippi. Mary, what would you add? What are you hearing from advocates about how they're planning for what's to come?
I think shows like this are a really important part of what's to come because there's a lot of misinformation about where the law is. I think it's also important because it's worth saying that when the Supreme Court starts dismantling abortion rights, it might not be that easy to understand exactly what's going on. The Supreme Court has some conservative members who are very canny and worried about possible popular backlash. And so I think a big part of what reproductive advocates are doing now is to sort of help people understand what the law is now. For example, after Alabama passed an abortion ban, it wasn't in effect, but people didn't know that, right? So even just informing people what they can and can't do at the moment is important. And then I think conversely, if the Supreme Court does do something to undo Roe, educating people that that's happened, because of course there won't be any popular pushback at the polls or otherwise if people don't understand what's going on. The other piece of this, of course, is that this is a state by state issue. So there are steps being taken in progressive states to kind of step up their efforts to make abortion more accessible. That's especially consequential in states, for example, like Illinois, which is bordered by Missouri, is near Arkansas, et cetera. So that kind of work is ongoing. Because, of course, if Roe is overturned, there will be a fight in Congress about federal legislation to protect abortion rights. There will be fights in every state, probably particularly heated fights in places like Florida, where I am, that are sort of neither red nor blue. And there will be ongoing fights about the Supreme Court, because if anyone has been paying attention to this at all should understand that no Supreme Court decision necessarily lasts forever, right? I mean, that's what pro-choice folks thought when Roe came down, that this was over. So a decision overturning Roe would not be the end, even when it comes to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And we have about a minute left. If Joe Biden wins the election and the Democrats take back the Senate and keep the House, what could the Democrats do?
Well, there already are a couple of different proposals for federal laws protecting abortion rights. The Women's Health Protection Act is the one that's probably received the most attention. So there could be a kind of federal statute protecting abortion rights. Of course, the difficulty there is that a conservative Supreme Court could either strike down that law or, you know, in a future election, a conservative Congress could repeal that law. But that's one option. Joe Biden has also talked about just today announcing that he would like to have a kind of bipartisan commission to study court reform efforts. So that means that changing the Supreme Court's composition in one way or another, or creating term limits or some other similar solution, might also be on the table. So there are lots of things that could be done at the national level, but there are some hurdles, I think, to any of them.
Mary Zeigler is professor at Florida State University College of Law. She's the author of several books, including her latest, Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, thank you for your work, and thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Becca Andrews is a reporter at Mother Jones. Her forthcoming book is called No Choice, which is based off of her 2019 cover story for Mother Jones about the obstacles of getting an abortion in the South. Becca, thank you so much for your reporting. The piece that we referenced is such an important piece, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And you can find that story along with Mary's at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. And I hope you can join us for tomorrow's Media Roundtable. We'll discuss a new Frontline documentary called Whose Vote Counts. It investigates voter suppression tactics ahead of the election. At least 40 million people have already voted. We will also discuss the Republican Party's efforts to block passage of a stimulus relief bill. Mitch McConnell reportedly told Republicans he didn't want to pass a bill because it would get in the way of confirming Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. Thanks for joining us.